Hello everyone, this is Bob Main, your host of today's survival show, where we help you harness the power of choice to live life the way you want to live it, not the way someone else wants you to, but to live it on your own terms and to strengthen your resolve. We make survival simple, not extreme, and what we talk about on this show is how to live a better life by doing things today, by thriving today so that you can survive tomorrow, changing your life today and making some different choices and doing some things differently to set yourself up so that you have a strong response in case a disaster does happen. We try to keep things practical, so if you are tuning in for the first time, welcome, and I want to let you know you have tuned in to a voice of reason in a chaotic world, and I hope you find this useful and practical. And I also want to welcome all of our international listeners, because that group of listeners continues to grow, so thank you very much. You're listening to episode 31 of today's survival show. It's Thursday, October 22nd. We have an interesting topic that I'm going to discuss. We're going to talk about urban self-defense and urban survival. Now, I know I've got a lot of rural listeners, people who live in rural areas. I'm jealous of some of the areas that you folks live in, because from what I'm finding out from members on the forum, you folks live in some very nice rural settings. And I got to tell you, suburbia here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area is starting to drive me a little nuts. But anyway, for those of you who live in the rural area, you're going to still get a lot of benefit from today's show, because a lot of what I'm going to talk about, defending yourself, and I'm going to talk about several different ways and several different aspects of defending not only yourself, but your home and your property. I think a lot of it's going to apply to you. Let me tell you why I picked this subject, folks, because as you know, I'm doing a series on planning. And I'm talking about the different ways that you should be preparing. Well, let's not forget about self-defense. Now, this is not going to be a gun podcast, all right? We're going to talk a little bit about firearms here, but it's not going to be just strictly a gun podcast. I think too many survivalists get caught up in guns and ammo, and I think a lot of folks go way overboard on guns and ammo, and unfortunately, they spend a whole lot of money on both of those, and they neglect a lot of other areas of survival. But self-defense is vitally important. If there's a disaster, there's a very, very good chance that you're going to have to defend your home, defend your property, even defend yourself if you're out and about the city or the county or even the state. Especially if you're having to evacuate, as I've mentioned before, you're going to have a lot of angry people and a lot of people freaking out and panicking. So self-defense could become very important. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today and the different aspects of it. And so before we get into the main topic, let me get a couple of announcements out of the way. By the way, I'm having the pleasure today of producing this show and recording it from my home office, which is really a treat. I haven't been doing too much traveling lately for the last few days. So again, this is kind of fun to be able to sit here with my laptop at my desk and record this show. If you've ever done this, or if you've ever tried to do a podcast like this, you probably know how much of a luxury that is. And if you haven't, let me tell you, it's just nice to be able to sit here in the comfort of my home to do this. All right, the announcements. If you haven't joined our forum, it's a great place to interact with other folks. We even have a very active a chat room in the forum that a lot of folks are really enjoying. And you can learn a lot from a chat room. I learned a lot just being on it last night. I also want to urge you to become a member of our Survival Activist Club. I talked about that in the last episode, and I'll just let you go ahead and read that on the forum. I've got an announcement on there what the Survival Activist Club is. Sure like to give away this prize to somebody on December 20th. And then I also want to talk about our sponsor today, Knives and Gear. Jeff's group, knivesandgear.com, excellent survival tools. You will find something on his site that definitely belongs in your survival kit. Not just knives, but he's got a lot of other interesting survival products, and I'll just leave it at that. I just want you to go to his website and check it out, knivesandgear.com. And that wraps up the announcements. I like to keep that short. All right, so let's dive into the main topic of today's show. And we're going to talk about urban self-defense. And as I mentioned earlier, for those of you who live in the rural areas, you'll find a lot of this is going to apply to you. But the concept of urban self-defense pretty much encompasses a few things. It entails, first of all, keeping yourself, your family, and your possessions safe and secure. It primarily involves four locations, and I broke this down into four locations to keep yourself well defended. First of all is your home. I've done some other podcasts on keeping your home defended, and I'll talk a little bit more about that today. Your automobile is the second one. Your work location, or at least on your way to your work location. And of course, if you're out of town, is the other location, keeping yourself defended if you're traveling. All four of these pose different problems, and they all kind of present you with different advantages and disadvantages and things you have to take into account depending on what situation you're in. So knowledge and skills and the tools to defend yourself gives you the ability to kind of tilt the odds in your favor if you are attacked. And we've had some people on our forum that have been victims of attack, and you need to read their stories on there because there's a lot that you can learn from that. In an urban setting, self-defense in an urban setting rarely includes battling the elements. Now, if you're in a rural area, obviously the elements are going to come into play. I am going to talk a little bit about that in this show, so stay tuned. But if you're in an urban setting and you're faced with a situation where the elements put you at risk, I consider that within the realm of more like wilderness survival. So you're going to have to pull up your survival skills for the elements, and we'll talk a little bit about that in another episode. I do plan on doing a wilderness survival episode. But if you're worried about things like freezing to death, it doesn't really matter if the large object next to you is a mountain or a skyscraper. You're pretty much in the same situation. So the elements aren't going to come too much into play, maybe a little bit in an urban setting. Now, that's not to say that battling the elements is always the same under every condition. I mean, for example, if you're in an urban setting, you know, wood is going to be in short supply, for example. Or if you're in the desert, you know, wood is going to be in short supply. So starting a fire in the center of your living room or in your in the back of your house, it's going to be a little tougher. All right? I mean, you know, if wood is in short supply, it's going to be a little bit tougher to start doing things like starting a fire. But there are cases in urban survival where dealing with natural or man-made disasters or earthquakes or chemical spills could make it kind of tough. And if the heat goes out in your home, if your furnace is out and you need to produce some heat, well, then you may have to start a fire somehow. You know, if you've got a wood fireplace, you know, learning how to properly use that and learning how to, and making sure that you've stored enough wood, even if you're in an urban setting, there's ways that you can store some wood, especially if you're in suburbia. So being able to have that ability and alternative methods of being able to cook while you're at home, you know, in case you've got to stay in case you've got to bug in, those are going to be important skills to learn. However, for most people, the heart of the matter, when we start talking about stuff like urban self-defense, are things like this. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter if the carjacker didn't get your BMW or if your Blu-ray player is still sitting on the shelf. If you're dead, you're dead. You have to be able to have a way to defend yourself. In a disaster, there are going to be people who are going to want to try to take what you have. I mean, let's face it, plain and simple. The have-nots will have a tendency to get violent. And the have-nots are going to try to take the resources, especially some of you who are real good at storing food, and some of you who are real good at storing the supplies that you need. There are people out there that are not going to be prepared. In fact, the vast majority of them, unfortunately, and they are going to come after you. So your primary goal should always be to minimize the effect of the conflict. Stay alive, stay intact, keep your home, keep yourself, keep your supplies well defended. I think the best way to accomplish this, first of all, is by avoiding trouble. I've been a big proponent of that. I think avoiding trouble is the best way to implement self-defense. Now, there's going to be times where you can't avoid it. And self-defense includes a lot more than just options for physically protecting your life. Don't forget about some of the legal and the moral ramifications of those options. Those are important, too, and we're going to get into some of those. Let's talk a little bit about the laws. You know, every country, every state, every county, every city and so forth, even some of the smaller cities, they have their own laws. And they have their own policies, both written and unwritten, that can affect your self-defense options. So, here's what I want to say. It's very vital that you understand how the laws affect your personal situation. I am not a lawyer. I'm going to put a disclaimer on that right now. I'm not a lawyer, and I can't begin to give you legal advice. You're going to have to research that yourself. But I'm going to give you some good ideas. It's going to be up to you to match them up with the laws in your area. You may not like the laws in your area, but they are what they are. Now, I'm going to make a suggestion. I suggest that you speak to, for example, somebody like a criminal defense attorney where you live and find out what your rights and responsibilities are. Find out what's legal and what's not. Don't ask a generalist. Don't ask a specialist. Don't ask the cop who works or who you know that works in your area. Don't ask a friend who says, oh, I know a lot about that stuff. All right, get with somebody who really does. I, you know, defense attorneys, whether you like them or not, I think they're a really good source of information as to what the laws are in your area, because they're engaged typically in that, especially if they're a criminal defense attorney. They're engaged in that just about every day. You know, where I live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, you know, our laws here could be significantly different from the laws, say, down in Austin, about 4 hours away. And, you know, if you're in Peoria, Arizona, your laws are going to be a lot different than Peoria, Illinois, for example, because of the disparity between the two states and how they view self-defense. If you're in Paris, Texas versus Paris, France, you know, the difference there is mind-boggling in the laws. So, you know, don't just assume that you know what the laws are. Ask a competent source. Make sure that you're talking to somebody who deals with this every day. Now, the next point I want to make is beware. Before you even think about the means of self-defense for your home, for your family, and for yourself, you should learn how to be aware and how to avoid trouble. Situational awareness. The best weapons and the best training and the coolest, most tricked out gear aren't going to do you any good if you're oblivious to your surroundings. I've covered this in other shows before. I've touched a little bit on situational awareness. I think by doing this here, it's giving me the idea to do a complete show on situational awareness. So that's coming up. I'm going to do some research on that. I've got some pretty good ideas on it already, but I'll do some research on that. But what I'm trying to say is be aware of your surroundings. It usually means trying to avoid it before it starts to affect your life. Knowing how to diffuse a situation is a lot better if you can do that than having to actually go to your weapons and defend yourself. Now, I'm not saying don't use your weapons. I'm just saying try to diffuse the problem first before you have to go to your weapons. Now, the next concept that I want to talk about is a concept called force continuum. Force continuum. Now, some of you may not like what I'm going to share with you, and I didn't like it too much either when I researched it, but it is reality. I like to talk about reality on this show. I like to keep things real and based in the actual fact. Most communities And this is a sad thing, but it's true. Most communities require that the force that you use to defend yourself be in proportion to the force of the attack. California comes to mind real quickly. Again, I don't like this. I think this is bogus. I think requiring somebody to use equal force and not overwhelming force to defend themselves is bogus. I think that's stupid. All right? But it is what it is. That's the law in some places. And, you know, for example, you know, if you're 6 foot tall and you're 250 pounds and somebody who's, you know, 5'2 and 120 pounds attacks you, some of the stupid laws say that you're already at a huge advantage because of your size, and if that smaller person has a gun, you can't respond accordingly, which I think is stupid. All right? But that, unfortunately, that is the law in some states. All right? And they have a term for this. It's called a disparity of force. Now, be mindful of that. However, I'm going to stop right here and I'm going to say this. All right? Those of us who believe in self-defense, especially those of us who believe a lot in the Second Amendment, we got an old saying, and you've probably heard this before. I'd rather be tried by 12 than carried by 6. And for those of you who are somewhat new to this, what we're talking about is we'd rather be tried by a jury of 12 people than be carried by 6 pallbearers. And no matter where you live, no matter what country you live, save your life first. That's the best advice I can give to you, is save your life first, deal with the rest later. Much better to be tried than be buried. All right, so that's my personal opinion on that. Now, the force that you're going to use, though, is going to be, it's going to vary based on the situation. And you got to start asking yourself, and this is kind of tough to do in a split second when things are in the heat of the moment, but you have to ask, is it moral or is it ethical to kill someone who's just stealing your stereo? In a lot of places, that would not be considered acceptable. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and in Texas and a lot of other states, you know, we have a law, we have the castle doctrine, which says our home's our castle. And basically, it is the law here in Texas that if somebody comes into my house and they're not authorized, and I haven't let them in here, and they have not left when I've asked them to leave, I have the ability and I have the legal right to use overwhelming force to remove that threat. But you have some bleeding heart people out there that say, well, is it moral or ethical to kill somebody if all they're trying to do is steal my Blu-ray? Well, I'm going to get to that. I say in most cases, it's definitely acceptable to use lethal force, even if they're just coming in to try to steal something. And I'm going to get to that shortly. I'll explain why I feel that way in about another 5 or 6 minutes. But first, let's talk about whether they are attacking you. A lot of pacifists are going to debate this point that I'm about to tell you. But from my perspective, I think it's always morally and ethically acceptable, if not desirable, to kill someone who's attacking you with the apparent intent to seriously physically harm you, kill you, or seriously physically harm your loved ones and your family. Now, again, there are some states with a bunch of pinheads that run it that don't believe that, but that's my belief. Now, lethal force means the force capable of inflicting permanent or serious injury on your opponent, like blindness, loss of limb, death, and that would include things like stabbing, breaking or crushing bones, obviously shooting. And in some communities, the concept of self-defense doesn't even exist at all, unfortunately. And that's kind of a sad situation. But I'm going to tell you that if you harm someone while protecting your property or your person, depending on where you live, you are going to have some legal implications, quite likely. But again, don't forget, better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6. So, let me address this, what I've just brought up here a few minutes ago. What if somebody is just coming in to steal your stuff? You know, folks, a lot of burglaries that were meant to be just that, they were meant to be just simple burglaries, a lot of them turn into violent altercations, especially if the burglar breaks in while you're at home. They weren't expecting you to be there. They're surprised. They're startled. If they're armed, it could turn ugly. All right? So, yes, that's why I say if they're just coming in to take your Blu-ray player, but they've got a 40 caliber Glock that they're armed with, yeah, I would say that you've got a pretty good reason there to respond with lethal force. I'd like to hear a good argument against that. If you got a good argument against that kind of situation right there, I'd like to hear about it. Okay? So, now that we've covered laws and legal implications a little bit, and we've talked about the force continuum, let's talk about some different ways to defend yourself, and in an urban situation mainly, again, and a lot of this applies to rural, and I'm going to talk about some of the advantages and the disadvantages of the different tools that you can use. Now, some folks think, when they're defending their home, that creating the illusions of being present, like using timers and lights to create, to make it look like you're home, they think that that's a deterrent. It's somewhat of a deterrent. But it's also important, don't make the error in assuming that just because a criminal is interested in burglary or vandalism, that they won't become violent, as I mentioned, if the opportunity presents itself. In some areas, about 30% of the rapes that occur in homes occurred when nonviolent burglars discover that she's at home by herself. Hate to talk about bad stuff like that, but it's true. But timers and lights, you know, making it look like you're home, they can be a deterrent. So it doesn't hurt to leave a light on. Even if you're gone, it doesn't hurt to leave a light on. I would say make sure that you are strategic about it. Leave a light on, but don't give them the ability to be able to look in through a window and see a lot of what's in your house. We shut all the blinds, but leave a light on. And you can still, you know, from the outside, if it's nighttime, you can still look in my house, even if I have all my blinds closed, you can still see that there's lights on inside the house. You can't see what's inside my house, but you can see that the light's on and it looks like we're home. Now the disadvantage of this is it only works on timid or casual burglars. It doesn't work on the pros and the druggies. Now, let's talk about verbal or sound makers, noise makers. I've covered this in a previous show, but I want to expand on this. Let's talk about verbal deterrence, verbal ways of defending yourself. Yelling fire or help, you know, to attract attention. That might work if you're in an area where people can hear you and they're willing to help or able to help. But it's very limiting. You know, many people have said, well, don't worry, the criminal's more scared than you are. Yeah, sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. So be careful about just relying on noise. It doesn't always work. But things like whistles, sirens, loud bells and things, they extend the range of your cry for help. So basically you can look at it that way. It's a range extender for your outcalling for help. Sirens and bells make it easier to signal if someone's holding a hand over your mouth, or if they're holding a knife to your throat or whatever. And if they're loud enough, they might startle a timid assailant. You know, they might give you an opportunity to escape, but I really don't think it's worth betting your life on those. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And they're almost useless if you're in your home and you're trying to signal your neighbors, because your neighbors might not be home. And they may not even care. And you know, from my time in a previous life where I used to do a whole lot of selling home alarm systems, it was really kind of funny. I used to have people that wanted to install a home security system that wanted me to program it so that it would call their neighbors. And some people still think that way. Now, you might have a good relationship with your neighbors, and if you do, that's great. But I got to tell you, I got to ask you a question. Are your neighbors home 24/7? I mean, really, are they home 24/7? A home invader is not going to announce his schedule. And what are your neighbors going to do? You'd be amazed. A lot of neighbors talk tough, But a lot of neighbors are not going to do anything. They're going to be afraid, especially if they were to get a call from your alarm system. Most of them are going to be afraid. And even if some of them are tough guys, and they're going to whip out their 45, and they're going to head on over to your house to check it out, most of them, I got to tell you, are really not all that trained on how to deal with the situation. So that's why I say, if you're going to put in a home alarm, which is a huge deterrent, it's a great deterrent, we're going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, get it monitored. You know, structure your budget so you can afford the $20 a month. You can get monitoring for $20 a month or less. Figure out what you have to cut out. Get it monitored. All right? Get professionals who will dispatch other professionals. And some of you might say, well, you know, in my area, I live out here in the rural, in the country, it's going to take forever for the cops to get here. They'll never be able to defuse the situation by the time they get here. Yeah, that's true, but after the crime has occurred, you know, hopefully if you're in a rural area, for example, hopefully you've taken the measures to defend yourself, you're still going to want the cops to come to the scene, all right, because there's a lot of advantages actually for the police showing up, especially if you have a good case for self-defense and you can explain, hey, officer, here's why this happened, because this is what this creep was doing. All right. If it's a non-monitored system, nobody's going to be calling the police to come out to your home and check things out. Now, I've talked about home alarms as being noisemakers, and you know, that's better. If you use them as a noisemaker, that's better than not having one at all, but still not good, not as good as having it monitored. Alarms, though, do discourage thieves, and they discourage home invasions. It's a proven fact. I've talked about this on other podcasts. Statistics prove over and over and over again that homes with alarms, with the signs and the stickers in the front and backyard, are invaded far less than those that don't have them. The common burglars, they're usually looking for easy pickings. Now, the professional burglar, your alarm might not deter them. But for the common Joe Schmo burglars that are just trying to, you know, get some easy pickings, yeah, they're probably going to leave your house alone and go somewhere else. And some other advantages of having an alarm is the cost is relatively low compared to an expensive firearm, for example, and there's no training required, and alarms are pretty much legal everywhere. See, here's a self-defense, here's a home defense item, an alarm system. I can't think of a place where a home security system is illegal. So if you're listening to this show and home security systems are illegal in your area, let me know about it. Because I've never heard of a place where it's against the law to have them. Sometimes you have to have a permit. It's an inexpensive permit. You know, usually it's like $25-$30 a year on the average, but that's a small price to pay for something that can help keep your property defended. Now, one more disadvantage of a home alarm I want to point out that, yeah, there is a downside that you're basically relying on other people for protection. You know, for example, the kindness of others or police or whatever, and that might not be very effective on the hardcore criminals. I understand that. Now, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about martial arts. Martial arts happens to be something I am a big fan of martial arts. Now, there's advantages and disadvantages to that. My son is very well trained in martial arts already at 11 years old, and he's getting better and better. And I will probably be signing up for some adult martial arts pretty quickly. I have taken some in the past, and it's time for some refresher courses. Let's talk about some of those techniques. You know, things like joint locking techniques that trap and control your opponent, empty-handed strikes, you know, open-hand strikes, things like that are all aspects of martial arts and unarmed combat. And there's some other more sophisticated means, manual means of resisting an attack. Martial arts can be effective under certain conditions. And I think the effectiveness of martial arts is good. It is a little bit limited. Let's talk about... Now, I'm not a big fan of relying solely on martial arts as your only method of defense. I'm a big fan of having as many tools at your disposal, but martial arts is one of them. Let's talk about some of the advantages of it. Obviously, If your hands and feet are your weapons, you can take them with you everywhere you go. You always have your weapons on you, your hands and your feet. And they'll pass through any weapon screening device, won't they? So you've always got it. Martial arts training can also help with providing you a good positive state of mind. This is one of the biggest advantages I think of it, is it teaches you the proper state of mind to put yourself in if you are attacked. Now, there's a downside to this too, though, is don't get overconfident. Just because you're well-trained in martial arts and you're well-trained in the mindset of defending yourself, be careful not to get overconfident. And probably the biggest disadvantage of martial arts is that it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort to become proficient. My son's been at it for 3 years now and still has a whole long way to go. You have to find a school or a course where the emphasis is also on street fighting, not tournaments or exercise. And this is, I want to very, very, you know, stress this point heavily. If you're really interested in martial arts for self-defense, find a school that emphasizes street fighting. There's different types. Mixed martial arts is a good one because they teach you a lot of aspects of street fighting. Krav Maga is also another good one. It's very important to recognize that even a martial artist with years of experience may not necessarily be the victor in a confrontation with even a semi-skilled thug that happens to have a knife or a gun. I'm not putting down martial arts because I just said I'm a big fan of it. It's a tool. Let's just put it that way. Don't rely solely on it. Just make that one of the tools in your arsenal. But get some street fighting training, not just tournament or style training or tournament fighting training. Learn how to be mean. That's what I'm talking about. Learn how to be mean. Because, I mean, if you're in a hand-to-hand combat, you know what the main objective is if you're in hand-to-hand combat? Your main objective, folks, is to live. I mean, style points are not going to do you any good if someone's got a knife or a gun. You want to live. You want to survive. That's why I say get some street fighting combat training. Okay, the next subject I want to talk about. Let's talk about self-defense sprays. There's a lot of various sprays that you can get for self-defense. Pepper spray being pretty much the most popular. Now, pepper spray is very, very versatile. Now, let's talk about how it's sold. It ranges. It ranges from little pen-sized pepper spray tools to, you know, they have a half an ounce in them, all the way up to, you know, 20-ounce fire extinguisher size. I've seen them as large as that. I've even seen some truck-sized riot control pepper spray machines. But obviously, you're going to be looking for the portable kind that are pocketable, that ladies can carry in their purse, that guys can slip in their pocket. So when selecting a pepper spray unit, there's a few factors I want to talk about. And some of the things you have to pay attention to is the chemical itself, the concentration of it, what's the spray pattern? All right, what's it going to do when you attempt to spray that? And what's the trigger mechanism like, and what's the size of it? Is it easy to carry? They have trigger mechanisms, and that's just as important almost as the trigger on a gun. Now, let's assume that the chemical is a chemical called OC, and I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly. Oleoresin capsicum, I think, is what it is, and that's one of the most popular chemicals in pepper spray. It's pretty much the most effective, and so if you do get pepper spray, that's probably what it's going to have is a chemical called OC. You have to be careful of the composition of pepper spray and what is the concentration of it. It can be as little as 0.5%, and it can be all the way up to like about 10% of concentration of the spray. And the quality can range extreme. Basically, you get what you pay for when it comes to pepper spray. Let me put it to you that way. I'm a big fan, if you're going to have a weapon like this, have as high a concentration as you can legally get away with. And again, check the laws. There might be laws in your areas that regulate pepper spray. You also have to pay attention to the pattern that's available. There are some pepper spray devices that shoot out a narrow stream. There's foggers, and there's different systems that are in between. Some shoot somewhat of a more narrow type of a fog type of a stream. The narrow stream has to be aimed, so that's one of the disadvantages of it. And it can be kind of difficult to hit somebody with it, but it has an advantage of a long range. Some of them will get out to 15 to 20 feet, and they're not affected by the wind as much. The fogger units might only go as little as 4 or 5 feet, but of course they don't have to be as aimed as precisely. They have a large cone-shaped pattern that pretty much hoses down everything in front of you with the spray. But the problem is even a slight wind can reduce the effectiveness of it. Sometimes even a slight wind can blow that pepper spray back at you, which isn't much fun. So that's some of the downsides to it. Now, the advantage of pepper spray is, you know, you can produce the spray from pretty much, you know, anywhere, wherever you can carry it, and you can produce it usually pretty quickly. You can spray an attacker from outside of arm's length, and therefore preventing him or her from getting close to you. And they're also pretty inexpensive. That's one of the big advantages of pepper spray, is they don't cost much. They also don't require a lot of training. I would suggest, though, that you do get some training. There are self-defense courses that will teach you how to use pepper spray. I'll find a list of some of those courses. I'll put them in the show notes. They'll give you some good training on how to effectively use the spray, because there are some good techniques that you can use that are, that'll make it more effective, whether you've got the stream type or whether you've got the fogger type. It doesn't matter. Now, there's some disadvantages. Some areas do make pepper spray illegal, so you need to check that out. And they cannot be taken on board aircraft. Now, let's talk a little bit about that, since we're on the subject of taking it on board aircraft. For those of you who are concealed carry weapons permit holders, some people don't think this is possible, but I prove it over and over again. You can fly with your weapons. I am a concealed carry holder, as you know, and I'm licensed with all the different reciprocity agreements that I have and the different non-resident licenses. I think I'm licensed in like 40 or 41 states or so. And I often, when I travel for business, I often fly with my handgun. You might be thinking, are you kidding me? No, I'm not kidding you. You can take a handgun on board an airplane if it's in your checked luggage, of course. Now, there are very strict rules that the airline is going to make you follow, but as long as you declare it, as long as you have it in a hard shell, lockable case, obviously unloaded, and you declare it when you get to the bag check, you have to tell the TSA that you are declaring a firearm. They will check it out thoroughly. Then they will ask you to fill out some paperwork declaring it. And, of course, they'll, you know, check you in with all your IDs and everything. And then they will ask you to place that form, your declaration form, inside the hard shell case. And they will ask you to lock your gun case with a TSA-approved lock that are fairly easy to buy, $20 or so, for the lock. And as long as you do that in their presence, then of course they're going to run it through their x-ray machines and they're going to check it out. But that weapon goes in your checked luggage with you. Okay? And then when you get to your destination, you basically just claim your luggage. And that's that. Now, I want to tell you something. I want to put a little little warning on this. Make sure that whatever state you are going to, make sure you're completely aware of their firearms laws. For example, if I'm leaving Texas and I'm going to California, I don't even bother. I don't take it with me. Because California gun laws are so restrictive, it doesn't pay. Maybe I shouldn't take that attitude, but I do. But, you know, if I'm leaving Texas and I'm going to, let's say, Missouri, I can carry in Missouri, and I have to be mindful of their laws and pay attention to what their laws are if they have some specific differences. But contrary to popular belief, yes, you can take your weapons with you. If you take pepper spray with you, make sure that you declare that. That's something you have to tell the security about, just like anything else. And make sure you know the laws in the state or the country that you're going to. Now, I got a little off subject there, but I wanted to throw that in. Let's talk about some of the disadvantages of pepper spray. The effect that they have is greatly diminished on people who are high on drugs or people who are drunk. The most important limitation to consider is your attacker's level of pain tolerance. You know, if it hurts, they might stop the attack, but generally they don't. Not if they're hopped up on drugs. If they're pretty well immune to pain and they really want to hurt you badly, that pepper spray is not going to do much to physically stop them. Now, some people think, well, what about a light? So let's move on to the next weapon, a blinding light. Well, if you've ever accidentally looked directly into a bright focused light, you probably understand how that can be disabling for a moment or two. And that moment that you can disable your attacker briefly with a light might be all you need to escape. So a blinding light, a very high-powered flashlight, that is a good deterrent. It is a good tool. So let's talk about the advantages of a strong flashlight. First of all, low to moderate cost. Doesn't cost much to get a good one. Most people can fit it into the budget, and there's not a whole lot of need for some high-quality training. And most people, here's the other good thing about it, most people are not going to perceive a flashlight as a weapon. But boy, they certainly are. In fact, a lot of flashlights have some sharp teeth on the end of it that you can use to jam into somebody's head, chest, arm, anywhere you want to jab it. Jab it into their groin, whatever. The sharp. There's some flashlights out there with some pretty sharp teeth to it, and they can definitely be a weapon, but it's not perceived by the general public as a weapon. And that's one of the basic advantages of it, in addition to the blinding light. Now, the downside, you know, it's primarily effective only at night or in dim light conditions. So that's going to be one of the disadvantages of it. Not to mention that you pretty much have to kind of aim it straight at their eyes to be effective. Now, let's talk about stun guns and tasers. Stun guns and tasers are handheld electronic devices. They give out a pretty nasty electrical shock. Now, advantages and disadvantages of those. Stun guns have anywhere from 2 to 4 electrodes that require you to actually touch the person to stun them. Tasers shoot out 2 electrodes to a distance of, I've seen some of them advertised up to 40 or 50 feet, generally about 15 or 20 feet. So they can shock a person remotely. Now, to a somewhat timid aggressor, if somebody's kind of, you know, not a real serious aggressor, the shock of those electrodes can be a huge deterrent. I wouldn't count on those as your sole means of defense either, though. The disadvantages is that somebody who's extremely aggressive, a stun gun may not be much. Now, some of the high-powered taser guns I've heard are as powerful as a 9mm handgun, so those are going to have more stopping power, but let's talk about some of those high-powered taser guns. In many areas, they're regulated just like firearms are. And in some areas that have very strict firearms rules, those strong taser guns are forbidden too. So, you know, despite being advertised as non-lethal ways of self-defense, they can also be fatal under some circumstances, and that's why they're heavily regulated. So check the laws. Taser guns are effective, but just make sure that you check the laws. Taser guns are kind of pricey. That's one of the disadvantages of them. You know, good ones can be $200 to $300, and they usually only give you one shot to neutralize your attacker. You really can't shoot twice. But I have heard from many people that tasers are very effective. So there's ups and downs. I don't use a taser gun. I don't carry one. I carry a real gun most of the time. Maybe taser is something I should think about for areas where I don't take my gun. But I think places like California, I'm going to do some research and put it in the show notes, but I think California's got some pretty restrictive laws in probably some of the parts of the northeastern United States and some of the countries that are outside the U.S. that limit handguns and limit guns quite a bit probably also have pretty strict restrictions on the high-powered tasers as well. So it's a good tool. Tasers and stun guns, don't rely on them as your sole method of self-defense. Now, the next item that I want to talk about, impact weapons. There's several different types of impact weapons. The first group of impact consists of everyday items. Like I talked about earlier, one of them was a flashlight. And there are pens that can be used as an impact weapon. So those are some of the more basic ones. There's another group of impact weapons that consists of things like nightsticks, nunchucks, batons, special types of baseball bats, things like that. The advantages of these weapons is, of course, low cost and easily available. You can obtain them pretty easily. And I don't know of any area where flashlights and baseball bats are illegal. So a great advantage is that they're legal just about anywhere. And another key advantage is that an impact weapon destroys, it pretty much destroys the frame of your assailant. You know, if you break your assailant's arm, if you can hit with it, an impact weapon can disable their arms. You smack them in the knee, it's hard, it's almost making, you can make it almost impossible for them to even walk towards you anymore. So you can disable them fairly quickly, but you got to be trained. You know, don't think that, oh, well, I've got a bat, or I've got some kind of a billy club, or I've got some kind of a tire iron or something like that, and I'm just going to rip them up with that. No, you're going to have to be trained. And there's self-defense courses out there that I mentioned earlier that will also teach you how to be effective with impact weapons. You know, one of the disadvantages of these impact weapons is that they require a pretty you know, good degree of strength to be able to incapacitate your attacker. And you also have to get pretty darn close to your attacker to be able to disarm them, or disable them, excuse me, with an impact weapon. So as a general rule, you want to try to stay away from your threat, not get close to the person that's attacking you. But if you do end up getting close to them, unfortunately, if that happens, those impact weapons are great. So learn how to use them. Now, let's move to another weapon, one of my favorite, edged weapons, knives, swords, machetes, things like that. The most important thing to remember about a knife is that a fighting knife, let's talk about the definition of what a fighting knife is. All right, and there's some posts on our forum about that. Check that out. We have a special section in our forum about survival knives and self-defense knife. Here's my definition of a fighting knife. A fighting knife is the knife you have with you when you get into a fight. Right? And seriously, I mean, I feel the same way about guns. What's the best gun to have? The one that's in your hand when you're attacked. That's the best gun to have. It's also the best knife to have. Now, don't discount small blade knives. Even a small blade can be devastating at close quarters, especially if you're trained. You know, if you're trained on how to use a small weapon, you can do a lot of damage with a small knife. Whatever you carry, train with it. You know, I mean, if you do things like if you study sword fighting but you're carrying a 3-inch folding knife, you're not going to be prepared because you've studied with a sword and you're at a disadvantage with your small knife. You know, there's an old saying, you know, I'd rather have the 22 in my pocket than the 45 in the safe at home. Same thing applies to knives. Train with it and carry it. And again, the advantage to a knife: low cost, widespread availability. And knives come in small packages and large sizes. And I think a knife or an edged weapon versus an impact weapon gives you a huge advantage. Not only are they easier to carry and conceal, but they're a lot more devastating. And there's also a lot of legitimate reasons to have a knife. It's a utility tool, right? Remember that. Now, there are knife laws, and knife laws vary. It seems like knife laws vary just as much as gun laws do. So again, check the laws in your area. Here in Texas, I carry, I think I got my knife, the new one I just got from Knives and Gear, the SOG Vulcan, fantastic knife. I'd have no problem if I had to defend myself with this knife. There's a picture of it on the forum. It's less than 4-inch blade. I think we have here in North Texas a 4-inch blade knife law. There's some states that don't have any. blade restrictions as far as the length of the blade. I'll tell you what, I practice a lot with this knife. I can get this knife out, I can deploy it, I can open it up, and I can move pretty quickly with it. So, you know, it's not my first choice of defense, but if I had to go to it and I was in close quarters, I'm constantly looking at different videos. I have never taken a knife training course, but I intend to, but I've watched a lot of knife defense videos, and I've actually memorized some of those techniques. It can be very lethal, and I can be lethal with it if I need to be. And again, a knife is something you can easily take with you when you're traveling, especially if you're flying. Again, put it in your checked luggage. Knives, you don't even have to declare. Just put them in your checked luggage. And again, understand the knife laws that govern the area that you're going to. Another advantage in knives is knives usually require a lot less physical strength than the impact weapons. Small people can be pretty lethal with a knife. Another key advantage, you know, obviously their cutting ability. They can slice muscles, you can slice tendons, slice the vascular system of your attacker. If you cut the tendons in your attacker's arms, he can't hit you with that arm. If you slice the tendons behind his knee, he can't pursue you. You're going to drop him pretty. If you know what you're doing, you're going to drop him pretty well by slicing the back of his knee. And they can inflict a lot of pain on your attacker. So if your attacker doesn't have a huge high pain tolerance, Just the pain that you're going to inflict is going to be a huge deterrent. Now, the downside of knives, edged weapons, is they are unlawful or limited in a lot of places. So again, you know, check out the laws. You also have to have some pretty good training and dexterity to be able to wield a knife in self-defense. And of course, you've got to be close to your attacker. That is actually a disadvantage. But since this show is largely about urban self-defense and urban survival, sometimes the knives are a good option. All right, so now let's talk about firearms. And again, in the beginning of the show, I talked about firearms and how some people over-prepare with their firearms. And so many people are about beans, bullets, and band-aids, and they get real heavily on the bullets and the ammo and the guns. And I think a lot of people in the survival community have spent way too much money on their firearms and not enough on other areas of preparation. But I do want to talk about firearms because they are a necessary preparation. I don't know how you can call yourself a survivalist without, if you're legally able to own a firearm. Again, I'll say that out there. If you're legally able to own one, I don't know how you can call yourself a true survivalist if you don't have at least one to be able to defend your property in case somebody is trying to take what you have. And firearms are generally the most effective choice you can make in self-defense. You know, and for obvious reasons, they're capable of reaching out a pretty good distance and striking your attacker hard enough to disable or kill them. Firearms destroy things. The shock and the blood loss often stops them. The advantages for a firearm for self-defense, the effectiveness, the range, when used properly in the hands of a trained person, not much else is more effective that private citizens can own. Now, people often ask, what types of firearms should I have? Depends on what your budget is. If you don't have any, the first thing I would strongly recommend that you structure your budget so that you can at least get a good quality handgun. I'm a big fan of handguns for several reasons. First of all, they're small, they're easy to conceal. You also have to think about from a home defense situation. If you're having to move around corners and move into tight spaces, if you have to retreat, if you have to get away from your attacker, it's easier to move into a tight space or move around a corner with a handgun than it is with a long rifle or a long shotgun. Handguns are not magical death rays. You know, don't believe the Hollywood crap about or some of the internet chatter you read out there about being able to, you know, drop your attacker with one shot with a handgun. It rarely happens. A lot of that is a bunch of baloney. But let's face it, how many of you listening to this show really want to get shot by a handgun? Nobody wants to, so they are a huge deterrent. So again, if you don't have any firearms, set a goal to get a good handgun. Now, what kind? That's an argument that can't be won. Here's what I will say. Spend a fair amount of money. You don't have to go out and buy a $1,500 handgun. Plenty of handguns in the $400 to $600 range that will do the job just fine. But get something good quality. Get something reliable. Get something by a major manufacturer that's going to be guaranteed pretty well, too. In case something goes wrong with it, you can send it back in and get service on it easily. But I think that should be your first goal. Once you've got that, the next goal, and again, you know, don't neglect all your other areas of preparation. Don't neglect your food storage. Don't neglect your water storage. You know, don't neglect your bug out bags. Don't neglect having a set of plans and in your important papers and plenty of cash and staying out of debt and things like that. But once you've got some of the other areas of your survival taken care of, and you want to get a second or a third weapon, the next thing I'd recommend after a handgun would be a shotgun. And I'm a huge fan of shotguns. I love shotguns for several reasons. First of all, they're probably the most versatile weapon that you can own. You can do just about anything you want to do with a shotgun. You can defend your home, you can hunt birds, you can hunt big game. You can shoot off flares. There's all kinds of things that you can do with a shotgun. So many different types of ammunition. You got birdshot, you got buckshot, you got slugs. There's so many, and you can keep all those different types of ammo in your shotgun all at one time. I would recommend getting a good pump 12 gauge or 20 gauge shotgun. Here's the other great advantage of shotguns. A good one can be had for a couple hundred dollars. They're not very expensive. Now, if you're unfortunate enough to live in an area where handguns are not allowed, that's a whole nother subject. That's a bad subject, in my opinion. But, you know, if you're in one of those areas where a handgun is not allowed, then I guess you have to make a shotgun your first choice. But inside of 25 yards, folks, and again, inside of 25 yards, I cannot think of a weapon that is easy to own and easy to fire that's more devastating than a 12-gauge shotgun with probably double-aught buck, single-aught buck, or number four buck. Take your pick. Any of those are pretty devastating. But inside of 25 yards, those do have very good one-shot stop power. So, you know, if you want something with good one-shot stop power, shotgun. But I think common sense will tell you the downside of a shotgun. They're big, they're heavy, they're really tough to conceal. They're much harder to get around corners and get into tight spaces, but they'll drop just about anything at 25 yards. I would say that should be, unless you cannot own a handgun, a shotgun should be your second choice. Now, the third choice might surprise you. My recommendation for your third choice of a weapon, again, before you start doubling or tripling up on handguns or shotguns, get this third choice first. Some of you are probably saying, yeah, I know what you're going to say, Bob. You're going to say get an AR-15, get an AK-47, get a high-powered, high-capacity rifle. Nope. I recommend the third choice be a 22 caliber. 22 caliber rifle or a good long-barreled 22 caliber handgun. 22 caliber has a lot of advantages. First of all, if you've already got a 9mm or 40 or 45 handgun and you got a 12-gauge shotgun, that takes care of your self-defense right there. So generally, you're not going to pull the 22 out for self-defense. Not usually. The 22 is great from a survival standpoint for hunting, especially if you're going to hunt small game. The 22s are quiet. You can buy subsonic rounds for 22s that don't hardly make any noise at all. So you're not drawing a whole lot of unnecessary attention to yourself when you fire a 22. You're not destroying very much meat when you actually shoot the game that you're shooting at. And the ammo is extremely cheap. So it makes good practice, especially a 22 handgun. You can practice your handgun shooting skills. You can get a 6-inch barrel Ruger Mark III 22 handgun for less than $300, and that makes a pretty good hunting, small game hunting tool as well. So your third choice should be a 22 caliber. I like 22 caliber rifles, especially if you already own a handgun, but a long barrel 22 handgun is not a bad choice either. And then the fourth choice would be that centerfire rifle. Now, I'm not going to get into the argument and try to solve, should I get an AR-15, should I get an AK-47, should I get a lever action 30-30, or should I get a bolt action 30-06? That's one of those arguments, again, can't be won. But here's what I will tell you. Just get a good centerfire rifle that has a pretty fair amount of power and just get good with it. Get some training. Again, it's the Indian, not the arrow. It's how good you are with what you possess, not actually how good the gun is. What's more important is how good you are with it. And there's all kinds of good training courses. Tactical Response has a lot of good training courses on not only pistols, but also rifles and shotguns, and so does Suarez International. I've mentioned those two organizations before. Gabe Suarez's organization, Suarez International, I'll put a link to both of those in the show posting. They also have some very good rifle training courses, shotgun, and handgun. So just get some good training with it. But those are the four that you need to set your goal. For those of you who can own firearms, you need to set the goal of owning those. One handgun, one shotgun, one 22, and one rifle. Now, after you've got those, if your budget allows, again, I'm going to make a suggestion. This is just my opinion. You're free to disagree with this opinion if you want. That's okay. Disagree all you want. Send me a good reason why you disagree. But have one of each of those first before you start doubling or tripling up on any of those others. I think you're very well-rounded from a self-defense and a hunting standpoint and the ability to bring meat in and put food on the table if you've got, when it comes to firearms, if you've got one of each of those four. All right? So, we've covered a lot of ground in this podcast. We've talked a lot about, and by the way, those firearms, even if you're in an urban setting, I would recommend one of each of those four. Okay, we talked a lot about firearms, and we talked a lot about self-defense. We've talked a lot about urban self-defense. I've got a question before I wrap this show up. Those of you in a rural area, did I cover something that helped you out today, too? I think I have. But I know we have a lot of urban area and suburban area listeners, so I wanted to cover this. I hope that as I bring this to a close, that I've made you think about some things on how to prepare yourself from a self-defense standpoint. Once again, I want to say before I close, do not neglect all the other areas of your survival preparations and don't start spending too much on the weapons. Just get the basics first. Pick one of these that I just covered. If you don't have anything for defense at all, pick one of these and get it. I would say you should have at least one of everything I've talked about today so that you have all the weapons necessary at your disposal depending on your situation. But again, slowly, surely, don't go into debt, don't make foolish mistakes buying some of these, and don't neglect your other areas of preparation. So with that, thank you for listening to episode 31. This is Bob Main, and you've just listened to another episode of Today's Survival Show, where we help you harness the power of choice to live the life that you want and to strengthen your resolve, and we make survival simple, not extreme. Thank you for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed this, and we'll catch you next time.